The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, March 24th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
What the health care bill actually achieves, and is there hope yet for a public option? A report back from the weekend's anti-war march, and 41st and Central, a new documentary about the Black Panther Party here in Los Angeles. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Barack Obama yesterday signed into law the landmark health care bill, H.R. 3590, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. He noted, however, that while this bill was major, it was not radical reform. While some of the most important provisions will not take effect until 2014 or later, there are some immediate benefits to Americans. For example, insurance companies will be prohibited from placing lifetime caps on their policies as well as from canceling coverage, except in cases of fraud or intentional misrepresentation. And children will not be denied coverage due to pre-existing conditions. Children will also be able to stay on their parents' plans until age 26. Adults with pre-existing conditions will be able to enroll in a new temporary high-risk insurance plan now, but the ban on denial of coverage to adults with pre-existing conditions will not take effect until 2014. The individual mandate to buy health insurance, as well as government subsidies to make that insurance affordable for low-income individuals, also goes into effect in 4 years. Meanwhile, over a dozen states have already filed suit over conditions in the health care bill. And as for the public option, there remains a measure of hope. Americans will find out during the ongoing reconciliation which, if any senator, will stand up to introduce a public option amendment. My guest is Ellen Schaefer, co-director at the Center for Policy Analysis. Welcome to Uprising, Ellen.
Hi, Sonali.
So we had talked to you before this bill passed. In fact, when the Democrats first introduced their, reintroduced their efforts about a week and a half ago to get this bill into law, do you think that at the basic level, from their perspective, they have succeeded and can claim victory?
Well, I think they can, and I think that the polls are starting to show that, too, that people are responding to the victory by saying, maybe this healthcare reform thing is a pretty good idea. And the favorables have gone up. And I think, as you said, a number of the features that would benefit some people are going into effect this year. There's also going to be a tax credit for small businesses that starts this year. So, the good guys, small businesses that are already providing health insurance, stand to benefit from that. So yes, I think they've got some wind in their sails from that victory.
There's an interesting article in the New York Times about how this, being the most landmark social reform that has come out of the Congress and White House in decades, mm-hmm. is actually very significant in reversing the trend away from Reaganism and actually doing very clear things, even if they're small incremental steps, to actually decrease wealth inequality. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss those aspects of the bill that tax people who are wealthier than the average American in order to pay for this?
Hello?
Yes, you're with us. Go ahead.
Okay. There are some changes, so I'm going to see if I can find the absolute latest. But basically, there's an increase in what we call the Medicare is paid through a portion of the Social Security tax, which is a portion of the payroll tax. That part of the payroll tax will increase. There's a new tax on investments that will be part of that, and also the part that wealthier Americans pay on that tax will go up, and I'll see if I can find the exact numbers for you, but that's going to increase. They also have decided there was going to be another tax on plastic surgery. They've decided to tax tanning salons instead, which is another way that they're going to pay for the bill. But I think the most significant increases on the wealthy are the ones that I mentioned, the investment income and straight income on the Medicare tax.
Now, explain why the aspect of the bill that involves people having been denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions, and that denial, you know, this bill will now reverse that denial, but that doesn't take effect for 4 years. Why the delay?
Well, the reasoning behind it is that in order to create a level playing field and make it viable for the insurance industry to not exclude people who have pre-existing conditions, you've got to have basically everybody in the pool. If you have people only buying insurance who are likely to want it, you're probably going to have sick people in there and thereby drive up the costs. If you have everybody covered, there is then no excuse, really, not that there was before, but from a business point of view, there's no reason and no excuse to exclude sicker people. You're going to have everybody in there, so you can't be denied. You're going to even out the cost, and you can't either deny or charge people more for being sicker. Now, that is accomplished through basically the individual mandate, where we're requiring that everybody pay into and buy private insurance, or a public option if we succeed in getting that by 2014. That has been delayed until 2014. The mandate that we all find some way to pay into coverage doesn't start for a couple of years. And that, again, is for a couple of reasons, part of it being political, part of it being that it'll take a while to operationalize the program, another part of it being that it makes the budget figures, frankly, look better for the administration.
I'm speaking with Ellen Schaefer, co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis. She's an expert on healthcare reform, and we're talking about the landmark piece of legislation that President Obama signed yesterday. So what about the fact that over a dozen states are, I understand, suing already over this healthcare bill? What exactly are they suing over?
Well, they're suing because they don't like it and they want to give a little steam to the reactionary response to the bill. It's a political response, but what they're questioning is the constitutional right of the federal government to mandate that the states do what this bill does. I don't think there's really a lot of legal heft behind that claim, and there are already groups organizing to respond to that claim, but certainly it's going to be a source of opposition, which is going to be continue probably. Well, it's certainly going to continue through the next couple of weeks, I think, depending on how popular or unpopular the bill proves to be. We'll see what happens with those lawsuits, but certainly initially it's an attempt to just rally opposition.
So now explain the legal procedure. The president has signed the bill that the House passed, but senators can still introduce amendments.
Well, senators can introduce amendments to the bill. The House passed a couple of bills. They approved the Senate bill, which the Senate has already voted on. They also approved a reconciliation package, which makes some changes to the Senate bill. So the question is whether, and that is what is before the Senate right now, is the reconciliation package. The question is whether the Senate is going to allow amendments to that, or if they're going to be able to squash the amendments to that package. It seems that the Republicans are determined to introduce amendments to that package, and it may be difficult to stop them. I think the question is whether Democrats will also introduce amendments. The assumption is that the Republican amendments will fail, and if that's the case, the Senate will pass the reconciliation package exactly the way the House did, and that will be the end of that. If there are, in fact, amendments to this bill in the Senate, something's going to have to go back to the House, and they're going to have to reconcile a reconciliation bill again. So the Democrats, there are sort of some competing trends. The Democratic leadership is trying to make sure that no new amendments are adopted, and as you suggested, there is some discussion that a public option amendment would still come back up. My guess as of yesterday was that was looking somewhat unlikely, but it still could happen, and it could happen as a show of support with the understanding that the majority wouldn't vote for it, but that there would be enough people voting for it that we'd have an indication that it was something to come up again.
So if a senator were to introduce a public option amendment at this point in the game, is there potential for it to derail if enough Republicans saw it as an opportunity to derail the whole process?
Yep. That sure could happen. Yep. Now, in a best-case scenario, it would get passed by the Senate, as you say, and it would go back to the House, and the House would vote for it. Seems like a hard lift.
So at this point, chances are quite small.
Now, that doesn't mean, and again, this depends on how the public expresses ourselves over the next couple of weeks, a public option certainly could come back as a freestanding bill, and there's also Representative Alan Grayson's Medicare buy-in bill, which has a lot of popular support in the House side, and that could come up independently as well, which would be even a better solution in a lot of ways. There's some issues in terms of how it would be priced and how affordable it would be, but certainly Medicare is what we've all wanted as the gold standard all along, is to have people give people the option to buy into that program. So that could get some momentum, and that would be a terrific resolution.
So, Ellen, then would you say that for those who are interested in a progressive, real reform of the healthcare system, strategically speaking, it might be best to introduce new legislation to move healthcare in the direction of Medicare for all, rather than to try to touch this sort of mess that has taken over a year to get to this point?
That seems to be where the balance of the wisdom is heading, yep.
And tell us a little bit more about the Grayson bill, because it seems as though Congress has spent a lot of energy on both sides of the aisle over this particular bill. I can't imagine that there would be much patience even for progressive Democrats to take on another bill.
Well, you know, I hear two different strains of thought from folks on the Hill, and the major one is what you've said, that basically, boy, they've had enough of this healthcare issue, and they want to immediately stop talking about this and turn to jobs and turn to the economy and foreign affairs and all sorts of other things. On the other hand, there are members like Mr. Grayson. You know, the public has gotten energized around this issue. A lot of members of Congress have gotten educated about it in a way that they never have really paid attention to it before. We have our own Dianne Feinstein talking about rate regulation and repealing the antitrust exemption for insurance companies. So there's some grounds, if the public demands it, to take this issue a step further this year. We'll have to see. Have to see what Congress and the administration are hearing and feeling and want to do, and what it is that we're telling them.
I'm speaking with Ellen Schaefer, co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis. We are examining the issue of healthcare reform and the bill that President Obama signed yesterday. Now, let's go back to what's in the bill. And, you know, it's only been public for a few days, and there's, you know, there were changes that were being made. But I mentioned in the introduction to our interview some of the benefits to children and young people, but then there's also some benefits to seniors. Let's talk about young people and children first.
Sure.
The fact that children are denied coverage now for pre-existing conditions may come as a shocker to those who are not personally affected. So this bill would now drop that?
Yep, absolutely. This year, can't do it anymore for kids.
So that's an immediate effect, immediate benefit for, say, parents of a child with some kind of a chronic illness who have not been able to get health coverage would see that immediate benefit. They would be able to get coverage for their child immediately.
Right. All the horror stories we were hearing about people, kids being born with a birth defect and then being excluded from health insurance because they had a pre-existing condition, meaning they were sick while in the womb, that goes. So that's a big victory.
And then children can stay on their parents' insurance plans until they're 26. Now, how would that work for an employer-based plan?
Well, if an employer-based plan covers dependents, typically they've covered dependent children until the age of 22. That would now be extended. So, you know, if your employer pays all the freight, they would continue to do that. If the employee pays some of the freight, that would continue as well. But the important part is that the dependent children wouldn't be dropped from the plan, would not be dropped from the plan. They could still maintain their coverage.
So employers would be required, if they offer coverage for dependents, they would be required to have that coverage be available for children all the way through their 26th birthday.
You've got it.
So let's also talk about seniors, who, of course, by definition, will fall under Medicare coverage. But under President Bush's tenure, there were serious attacks to the prescription drug coverage part of Medicare. What does this bill do on that front?
Well, the difficult parts about Part D, the prescription drug coverage, but the worst part has been the donut hole that it covers prescription drug costs up to a certain point, and then it leaves seniors vulnerable for several thousand dollars worth of out-of-pocket expenses. Starting immediately this year, seniors who face that expense will get $250 back as reimbursement so that they won't face that problem. And the donut hole will, over time, be gradually closed so that by 2019, a ways away, but it will be, it will happen, that donut hole will close. But starting immediately, folks who are caught in the lurch up to $250 will get that money back.
And briefly, again, just going over the issue of people with pre-existing conditions, adults with pre-existing conditions, they still, you know, for the next 4 years will have to struggle with being denied coverage, but they can enroll in a new high-risk insurance plan. So does that mean basically for the next 4 years they do have the option to buy an expensive plan with high deductibles but at least have some coverage for 4 years before they can enroll in regular plans?
Yeah, they will, and we have a high-risk plan now in California that only a small percentage of the people who need it actually enroll in. Part of the problem is that it hasn't been very well subsidized, and there's going to be new federal money going into that high-risk pool, so it will be less expensive than it is now. Exactly how much, I don't know, but there will be additional millions coming into California to subsidize that pool.
And when we talked last, we had talked about women and reproductive rights. The bill that finally was signed by the president, would you say that that was a victory for Republicans?
Yeah, I would say it was a victory for Republicans.
Are you with us?
The call forwardings, it'll pass in a minute. There was the price that was extracted by the anti-women Democrats in the House side was that the president would issue an executive order, which doesn't, as far as most people who I've talked to have looked at, doesn't say anything too much different, which is bad enough as it is from the Hyde Amendment in terms of no federal funds going for abortion except in the case of rape, incest, or a threat to the life of the mother. But the language that's in the Senate bill, which will be adopted, certainly is worse than the Hyde Amendment. It places new restrictions on people paying for insurance with their own private funds, and the fact is that it was used as a political football and that women's rights did take a step backwards in this bill, and I think it's important for us to, you know, recognize the step forward that we made but stay angry and make sure that we continue to organize on that issue.
And what about immigrants' rights? I understand that under this bill, even those immigrants who are undocumented, even if they have the money to purchase health insurance, will not actually be allowed to do so.
Well, they won't be allowed to do so through these new exchanges, and how the exchanges are going to work, frankly, is a little bit of a mystery because the House bill would admit a national exchange. The Senate bill calls for state exchanges, and perhaps there will be some leeway at the state level, particularly, again, in a place like California, where immigrants are such an important and productive part of our population. There are also going to be two national insurance plans, so it kind of remains to be seen how that's going to be stitched together. But in the broader picture, as you're saying, immigrants took a hit in this bill, and I think it's really important that on Sunday, as Congress was voting on this issue, that there was an impressive march for immigrants' rights. And I think, again, at the same time, we have to say, at the same time that we're seeing these advances in law, the politics of exclusion and discrimination and the level of vitriol and viciousness on these issues, it really has been magnified. And I think supported by the opposition leadership, that there's been such an increase in hate speech in the Capitol and quite outrageous behavior even by opposition members of Congress. I think it's something we all need to take stock of and recognize as a trend that's coming at us from the other side. Something to be aware of and something to oppose.
Finally, Ellen Schaefer, is there hope on the state front for a Medicare-like system, state by state, either here in California or other states?
Yeah, I think there is hope. I think it's not a slam dunk. I think we have passed single-payer legislation, Medicare for All-type legislation, where you would automatically pay in and automatically be covered. We've passed that kind of legislation twice through the legislature. It's been defeated. It's been vetoed by the governor. We'll have another governor next year. It remains to be seen who that's going to be. But I think certainly the insurance industry is going to be very active, and employers as well, I have to say, are going to be actively opposing that on the state level as they have been nationally. I think the advantage here in California.
Why would employers oppose that? I mean, wouldn't a Medicare system benefit employers?
You would think that it would. Historically, they have opposed these kinds of changes, partly because they like having an employment-based system for health insurance. It helps control the workforce. We're not as likely to quit or strike or leave, take sick days if employers control how our benefits work. And they're also tend to be politically conservative. We might have noticed that. So in terms of where they're going to throw their allegiance, they have pretty generally been in lockstep with the American health insurance plans in opposing this set of health care reforms and probably will continue to do so, have opposed, taken San Francisco to court over our attempts to impose fees on employers so that we could expand benefits here in California for health insurance. So employers historically, even though they could save money and the bigger ones do business internationally and know that these social insurance systems work for them better and save them money, politically they have not supported them. They've come out pretty much against them. Now, again, maybe with the growth of green economy in California, maybe there'll be enough political or at least some political momentum on the other side from green small businesses, certainly in a constituency to talk to. But it's going to be a fight. We do have a lot of creative people working and mobilizing and advocating for that kind of a change on the state level. I'm hopeful that what we'll see is the synergy between activists on the state level and folks who will also lend support to changes on the national level. As you point out, Sonali, a lot of these changes on the national level won't go into effect until 2014. Maybe we want to see some legislation that moves the date up on some of those changes. Maybe we want to see more of a Medicare for All type system nationally. There are a lot of things that can happen in a progressive direction. So I think if there's some coordination between the terrific state-based activists that we have in California and also around the country, which was another part of your question, there certainly are people in Pennsylvania and Minnesota, New York, Maryland, a lot of places that are looking at these kinds of state-based changes. If we have an alliance, we can get a bunch of stuff done.
Ellen Schaefer, I want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on this issue, and I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sonali. Bye-bye.
Ellen Schaefer is co-director at the Center for Policy Analysis, and we've been discussing healthcare reform. After today's Subversive Historian, we'll have this week's Who Said That contest, and then a report back from this past weekend's anti-war march here in Los Angeles. And finally, we'll be joined in studio by a couple of filmmakers of a new documentary called 41st and Central, the story of the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on March 24th, 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador was assassinated. 30 years ago, in the midst of a bloody civil war, Romero gave a homily a day before his death that was broadcast throughout the Central American nation. In it, he implored the rank-and-file members of the National Army to stop killing their fellow peasants. His voice spoke with courage despite repeated death threats as he said, "No soldier is obliged to obey an order that that is contrary to the will of God. Falling on deaf ears, Romero's plea to the soldiers themselves immediately put him within the assassin's scope. The next day, as Romero gave a homily at an evening mass, a single bullet pierced his heart, killing him within minutes. As this anniversary illustrates, the killers could not silence the memory of this example of faith and justice that thrives to this very day. Archbishop Oscar Romero may not be famous enough for the recently revamped conservative textbooks in Texas, but his story is just fine for the subversive historian. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
No more lies.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Who is it?
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Run.
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Before. It's time now for our weekly contest, Who Said That?, a partnership between Uprising and the Pacifica Radio Archives. Here's how it works. We play you a soundbite from deep within the archives' vault, and you have to guess who said that. To win the CD we're featuring, just call in and identify the voice. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
It is quite pointless to talk about the unconscious unless we see it rooted in these constitutional differences which make us the individuals we are.
And if you know who said that, and if you haven't won in the past 12 months, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets of several cities across the United States this past Saturday to mark the 7th anniversary of the U.S. war on Iraq. The largest protest took place in the nation's capital, as at least 8 people were arrested for laying mock coffins outside the fence of the White House. Locally in Los Angeles, thousands marched and gathered on the corner of Hollywood and Vine to call on the president to end the war and occupation of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Vietnam War veteran Ron Kovic led the protest, and speaker at the rally included Shakil Sayed of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, mayoral candidate Stevie Marino, and KPFK's own Blaise Bompain. Corporate media coverage of the LA anti-war march was scant, as just a sole photo of the demonstration was published on the back page of the California section in the Sunday edition of the LA Times. Uprising correspondent Martina Steiner, however, was present at the Hollywood and Vine gathering, and she filed the following report, including interviews with demonstrators and sounds from the stage.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Troops out of Afghanistan. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Troops out of Afghanistan. Thank you very much, and God bless all of you.
I'm Mario Alfaro from the FMLN, Los Angeles.
What does FMLN stand for?
Frente para Mundo Martí por la Liberación Nacional en Los Angeles.
And what does that mean in English?
English, National Liberation Front in Los Angeles.
And why are you here protesting the war?
We're protesting here to show support for the families that have been losing kids in the war. We're here in this protest because we feel this our responsibility as North Americans that we need to bring the troop back to the U.S. We need more funding for education, for housing. We don't need no war.
How do you feel the war has affected you and your family in the last year?
Affecting a lot because my cousin, my sister, my brother, they're already losing their jobs because there's no funding. My friends, they're teachers. They're already got laid off. So it's been affecting all my families, not just my family, all my community in general.
My name is Rosemary, and I'm here to protest for the war. And why are you here to protest the war? Because I think it's wrong that we're fighting in another country that we shouldn't be there. Why do you think we should be there? It's none of our business. How has it affected you? Has it affected you and your family? Yes, it has, because, I mean, it's teaching our kids that we should not be fighting for something like oil, or it's just bad. Are you a mom? Yes, I am. What do you tell your kids about the war? That it's bad. What do you think as a mother thinking about all the families in Iraq and Afghanistan? I've seen a lot of pictures that have broken my heart. kids dying on the street. I mean, it just breaks my heart in general.
As students, we are gathering from all around the state to say, Mr. President, we are the future, and we need education. As veterans, we are saying today, Mr. President, we will not fight your battles anymore. We will not spill our blood for you anymore. We will not give our lives for you anymore. And for the profit of the corporations that run these wars and the profit off of the deaths of our brothers and sisters every single day in the war. Today, let us stand shoulder to shoulder in the solidarity with the people of Iraq, with the people of Afghanistan, and with the homeless men and women and children of America, and say that today we will stand up and we will form a movement and we will be back in the streets every day until we get our demands.
My name is Kat Carrito, and I'm here with the Filipino community of Los Angeles.
And why did you come as a group here today?
I came here with various Filipino organizations, and you know, we're here to stand in solidarity with all the struggles of people all over the world who have experienced war. Filipino women have been, Filipino women have been victims and sufferers of war and U.S. military occupation, and to honor those women who came before us and who continue to fight that struggle, those of us here in Los Angeles, this is the least we can do is be here today.
And what is the tag that you're wearing around your neck today?
The tag that I'm wearing is representing, the Gabriella Network and all the women are wearing tags today that are honoring women who have died who have died because of war.
So I am wearing PFC Adriana Alvarez, who was a Marine who was killed during the Iraq War. If you could say one thing to the president about the war and how it's affected your community, or what you would like done about it, what would you say? Big question.
I want to say I believed in you, and now you screwed it up. I would tell the president to take back all that funding that he recently assigned back to the war, and to stay true to the promises that he had in his campaign now that he's president, to end the wars in Iraq.
I'm Alejandra Rishton, and I'm here because I'm a vet. I served for 3.5 years, and I never went overseas, but I saw a lot. I worked for psychological, or not for psychological, I did propaganda for the Army, so it was an interesting time.
What happened there? What did you see that
Well, we go to school to be graphic designers, right? And so they teach you how to send a message, how to add the emotion to the messages that you're sending. And once they teach you how to construct it, you deconstruct everything around you. You notice that everything you're seeing is propaganda, and it's very scary.
How has the war affected your life? Are you serving now?
I'm not serving. I'm a veteran. My husband's a veteran. We have 3 kids. 2 of them were born in Army hospitals, so big part of our lives.
How has it affected your life or your kids' life?
Every aspect. My husband served. He's got, definitely, we both have from the Army, PTSD. Every day, little, you know, work, extra work to get through it.
How many kids do you have?
Looking up there, I have 3 kids. I had my first kid, my first daughter, when I was 16. And so I didn't have any parental support. We were living on our own by the time I was 16. 17, 18, 19, we made it. 20, we made it. And then everything fell apart. Because I didn't have the education or the economics behind it, I couldn't get a job with healthcare. All I could get was, you know, 3 or 4 20-hour-a-week jobs. We really didn't have the option.
The option what? Not to go.
We needed the health care. We needed the money. There was just the 2 of us on our own then. So,
do you think, has the Army delivered on its promises, like what it said you would get once you were finished serving?
You know, I have to say, and this is the argument I gave to everyone in the Army, that they do give you what they tell you they're going to give you, because it's a socialized system. Everyone in the Army gets promoted equally. Everyone in the Army gets health care. Everyone in the Army gets paid every 2 weeks. You don't find that anywhere else. They try to make, you know, tell you it's scary. They don't want you to see that that's how they keep people in the service. If they gave us all health care, half the service wouldn't be there. I know I was there. That's why most people join. Healthcare and money.
My name is Iña Martinez, and I'm originally from the Basque Country, which is here. It's an occupied country like Palestine. Part of it is occupied by Spain, and part of it is occupied by France.
And why are you here at the protest today?
To get peace.
Do you live in the United States now?
Yes. I'm a U.S. citizen. And
how has the war affected you in the last 7 years? How do you think it's affected your life?
Well, I moved here, and straight away after I moved, the war started. So I was very shocked that everybody would go with it. Like, it's okay if there is war. And I was like, no, it's not okay. So every time there is a demonstration, I'm there, and I try to convince people to come, and that's my life now. I belong to a group that is called Peace with Justice, back where I live, in Claremont, Pomona. It's Peace with Justice, center of the Pomona Valley.
My name is Sun Young Yang. I'm a grassroots organizer with the Bus Riders Union. And why is the Bus Riders at the protest today?
We are a multiracial and a multilingual civil rights and environmental justice organization, but we also take a very strong position against the U.S. occupation of many nations, including Iraq and Afghanistan, and the military assaults and aggression that Obama is planning around Latin America and the rest of the world.
How has the war affected what the Bus Riders Union does in Los Angeles?
Well, many of us know the connection between the riches that corporations take from government here are also the same ones who are benefiting from the military foreign policies of the United States, right? Both the military and the economic policies. So many of our members are from the third world. They're from El Salvador, they're from Nicaragua, they're from Korea, you know, all those folks who have been impacted by U.S. foreign policy in their motherlands.
My name is Ryan Endicott, and I'm a Marine Corps infantry veteran. I served from 2004 to 2008, and I served in Iraq in 2005. After witnessing the atrocities and the war crimes that I witnessed overseas, I came home, and it was difficult for me to transition into civilian life. I felt failed by the government. I felt failed by the country that I served for, and I felt alone, and it was only a matter of time before I fell into a personal time where I needed to find an outlet, and I found Iraq Veterans Against the War online at ivaw.org, and I met up with other veterans who felt the way I did, and now I know that I don't do this just because I like to or want to. I do it because I feel morally obligated to try and fix some of the wrongs that I've committed and some of the atrocities that I witnessed. And while I know that I can't fix everything I did, maybe I can spread a message of truth and let the people of America know and the people of the world know what's really going on in these occupations, and in hopes that we can prevent these atrocities from happening farther.
What did you experience, either one thing specifically or just a general, what did you experience that made you come back and join a group against the war?
It took some time for me while I was in the war to really figure out how I felt, but after kicking in countless doors in the middle of the night and dragging women and children from their beds by their hair and just seeing all of the death and the destruction and that was going on to these their infrastructure, their buildings, and their society, and all of that, I felt morally damaged, and I couldn't handle it anymore. And upon returning, I led down a path of self-destruction because I couldn't handle the atrocities that I witnessed, and so it was really only a matter of time before I found the movement. And when I did, I knew that this was what was right. I knew that what I had been fighting in the war was wrong, and what I fight for today is right.
How old were you when you joined the service, and how old were you when you got out?
I joined the Marine Corps when I was 20 years old, and I got out at 24.
As a veteran, if you could tell, like, the president or the head of the Army, like, one thing, what would it be?
I would say, Mr. President, respectfully, these occupations are morally wrong and that the atrocities that go on overseas are not right, and that the truth is there, and we know the truth as a movement. We know the truth as a veteran. I know the truth. I was there, and I would ask him graciously and beg him graciously to please remove our troops, bring them home, give the reparations to the Iraqi people and the Afghani people that they deserve to rebuild their country, and to give the veterans who fought blood, sweat, and tears for this country the health care and the education benefits that they need in order to prevent atrocities from like this from ever happening again.
You've been listening to a special report by Uprising correspondent Martina Steiner of the anti-war march that took place this last Saturday on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have the answer to this week's Who Said That contest, and then 41st and Central, a new documentary about the Black Panther Party in L.A. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is KPFK senior producer Christine Blasdell taking a moment to thank all of you wonderful listeners out there who pledged support to KPFK during our last fund drive. It's because of you that KPFK can continue to be the voice for the voiceless. I also want to let you know that if you'd like to get a hold of one of our super hot thank you gifts, we've got the top 10 most requested gifts available at kpfk.org until March 31st. So if you still want to support KPFK and get some great goodies in the process, maybe the Consuming Kids DVD or Dr. Gwen Scott's 3-DVD set, Natural Medicine, or maybe the People Speak DVD featuring Howard Zinn, just log on to kpfk.org and pledge online. But you better hurry. You only have until March 31st.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Gohatkar. Before we go to our final story, the winner of this week's Who Said That contest is Jeremy Thayil. Congratulations, Jeremy, for guessing the correct mystery speaker, who is Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley was an English novelist and critic. He was perhaps best known for his novel Brave New World and other titles, including The Doors of Perception. He began as a humanist and a pacifist and later became intrigued by philosophical mysticism. By the time of his death in November 1963, Huxley was considered a leading modern intellectual. We'll send a copy of the CD, The Physical and Psychological Self, a lecture by Aldous Huxley in 1959, to our winner. Let's take another listen to the soundbite we played earlier.
It is quite pointless to talk about the unconscious unless we see it rooted in these constitutional differences which make us the individuals we are.
And for those of you who didn't win, you can order the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. In the 1940s, the grandchildren of former African slaves began migrating from southern states to Los Angeles in search of a refuge from racism, only to be greeted by more racism. With crosses burning in Inglewood and Culver City as late as the 1960s, a militant police force led by Chief William Parker that drew support from the FBI and recruited officers from the South, Los Angeles was not the bastion of freedom that African Americans had hoped it would be. Enter the Black Panthers. 41st and Central, the untold story of the L.A. Black Panthers, is a new documentary written, produced, and directed by Gregory G. Bone Everett, himself a son of a Black Panther. It traces the history of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party from its inception to its demise. The film explores the party's face-offs with the LAPD and the US organization, a rival group, as well as the UCLA killings of the charismatic Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and John Huggins, and the 1969 shootout between the LAPD and the Black Panthers on 41st Street and Central. The film features new interviews with former Black Panther Party members, including Erica Huggins, Ronald Freeman, Wayne Farr, Jeffrey Everett, Long John Washington, and Muhammad Mubarak, alongside former LAPD Chief Bernard Parks, US member Wesley Kabila, and UCLA Professor Scott Brown. These interviews, combined with archival footage, make 41st and Central a compelling picture of the often overlooked issue of racism in Los Angeles and the revolutionary Black movement that tried to fight it. Joining me in studio is a writer, director, and producer, Gregory Everett, and Gary Walker, the producer. Welcome to Uprising, Gregory and Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Your film is going to be starting a one-week-long engagement at a local theater this Friday, and we'll give our listeners information about that. But Gregory, first, how did you get involved in this project and why?
Well, Gary and I spearheaded this project along with someone whose name wasn't just mentioned, and I got to mention his name, Roland Freeman, the brother of mm-hmm. Ronald Freeman. Roland is also a co-producer on the film. And Gary and I met Roland in 1992 at a UNIA meeting, which is the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the followers of Marcus Garvey, the Garveyites. They were having these meetings at a place called the Elegant Manor in mid-city L.A. on Arlington and Adams. And we went to this meeting, and we met Roland, his brother Ronald, a brother named Long John, sister Samaya, Joe. We met about, you know, 5, 6, 7. We met Didon. We met all these Panthers, and my father had been a Panther. But at this time in 92, I didn't have too much of a relationship with my father, so I was very interested in the Panthers, and particularly the what I call the L.A. Panthers, but which technically is the Southern California chapter, which was the largest chapter. It was from San Bernardino, Riverside area, all the way down to San Diego. So obviously being the largest chapter and having the most members and dealing with the LAPD and law enforcement here in Southern California, they had the most casualties doing the their run. So it was just a very interesting idea. Gary and I were film students at the time and, you know, just getting into the industry as far as working features and music videos and whatnot. And we thought this would be a good idea for a documentary film. The problem was at that particular time, the technology hadn't really – it wasn't there for independent filmmakers just to go out and do your own thing like it is today. So once this technology became available to us, we decided to just do the film ourselves and not wait around for funding and that type of stuff, just go ahead and make our movie.
For those who didn't live through 1960s Los Angeles – what was the atmosphere like, particularly for young black people, and how did that provide the backdrop for the rise of the Black Panthers here? Gary?
Well, back in the 1960s, many people looked at L.A. as Hollywood, and we all know it was a lot more to it than just that. You know, we know how the police treated people because I was, back in the 1960s, of course, I was a young kid, so I was just right a generation just right behind a lot of these guys who became Black Panther. So the backdrop in L.A., that's how it was in L.A. And my dad was telling me stories about I would go to these nightclubs in the 80s. So, yeah, I remember that club back in Inglewood. There was no blacks allowed back there. Mm. So a lot of that was going on in Los Angeles.
And somebody in the film compared the LAPD in Los Angeles to the Nazi Gestapo.
Yeah, that would have been Roland as well as Erica.
Yeah.
Erica Huggins, you
Roland
know.
Roland Freeman, Erica Huggins.
Yeah, and there was no shame to the game. A lot of the historical footage we use in the film was shot by the police. And it shows them dragging people out of cars, pulling guns on them, telling them, you know, make one false move, you're a dead man. The police shot this. We have the footage.
And they would recruit officers like from Texas who were very used to Jim Crow laws and that type of police activity
down there. So blacks escaping the racism of the South came here to face the racism of the South.
Yes, and another thing we make very clear in the film, and this is by a brother who also we didn't mention, Kumasi, who's in the film, who gave us a very electrifying interview in the film. Everybody didn't come here looking for great opportunities. A lot of people got run out the South. And the children of those people had a very different attitude about the way that they were going to deal with things once they got here. Also, if you look at this time, there's some other things that were going on worldwide and also just in other parts of the nation that was really affecting the people out here, the young people out here. They were seeing on television black people, which generally during this time we're talking about the late 50s into the early 60s, black people on television were usually being having dogs sicked on them or hoses put on them, as you saw these events that were happening down south. These were the relatives of the people that became the Black Panthers. These were places that their families had left from and migrated from, and now they're seeing this stuff going on. And so people here in Los Angeles were very, very angry about what they were seeing, and they were tired of it, and they weren't going to take it anymore.
Tell us about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. Why was he so important?
Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, like he used to say, like a bunch of greens. And he's just an incredible person, you know. And, you know, I don't want to give away too much of the film because we want people to come out and see the film.
Yes.
But his character arc in life is one that's just incredible. He was a member and leader in the Slauson gang, which was the biggest gang at the time. He was a clerk at a department store. He was one of the first youth to join the Nation of Islam once a mosque was created out here by Malcolm X. And then he went to prison for armed robbery. He attempted to rob a bank. And while he was in prison, he met Eldridge Cleaver. And they became very, very close. And their plan was that when they got out of prison, to continue Malcolm X's work and bring back the Organization for Afro-American Unity. But Eldridge got out before Bunchy. Eldridge joined the Black Panther Party. Eldridge made Bunchy, when he got out shortly after Eldridge did, aware of what was going on, introduced him to those people up in Oakland. And after a process of really figuring out if this is something he really wanted to do, and once he was given the okay that if he started a chapter in Southern California, that would be his chapter and he would be in total control of it, Alprentice Bunchy Carter made it available to the young people of L.A.
And if you watch the film, you'll find out, and if you know your history of the L.A. Black Panthers, you'll find out what happened to Carter. The film is called 41st and Central, The Untold Story of the L.A. Black Panthers, and there's a limited one-week engagement at the Culver Plaza Theaters beginning this Friday, March 26th, and that's located at 9919 Washington Boulevard, 9919 Washington Boulevard, Monday through Thursday at 12 noon, 2:45, 5:45, and 8, and then Friday and Sunday, there are several screenings as well, and we'll put this information on our website at kpfk.org/uprising later today as well. So why is this the untold story of the LA Black Panthers?
Well, it's the untold story because it's the first time it's being told in this much detail. There was another movie that inspired us called Fire This Time, and I believe this film is on Rhino Video, and there was a small part of a movie called Bastards of the Party, probably about 5 minutes, where they spoke about Bunchy Carter and John Huggins. And, you know, this part I don't mind giving up because it's public record, but Bunchy Carter and John Huggins were murdered on the campus of UCLA on January 17th, 1969, by members of the US organization.
Let's play an excerpt from the documentary 41st and Central. This is an excerpt of Erica Huggins talking about Bunchy Carter.
All of a sudden, the doors burst open, and in walks this guy, Bunchy Carter, looking like a king, a prince, that he was. And he came in with about 20 soldiers, and they ringed the room. They were strapped. Everybody was like, whoa, what is this, you know? And Bunchy marched up to the front of the gathering, and I'd say there was maybe 150 people in the room. And he said, my name is Bunchy. Like a bunch of greens, and I'm here to say that the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party is now in place, and we're here to say, snapped his finger, unrolled a poster, brother on the side, opened the big poster of Huey P. Newton sitting in the chair. This is Huey P. Newton, Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and Huey P. Newton is the leader of the Black Panther Party, and there's only one Black Panther Party.
And that's Erica Huggins talking.
That is actually Elaine Brown.
Elaine Brown, I'm sorry.
Yes,
you're
yes.
Right. I made the mistake.
Yes.
I meant to say Elaine Brown,
yes.
Who actually has been a guest on Uprising. Yeah. Erica Huggins is also featured in the film.
Yes.
My guests are Gregory Everett and Gary Walker, both of them producers of the film 41st and Central. Gregory is also the writer and director of the documentary, which starts a one-week limited engagement this Friday. So why is the film called 41st and Central? What happened there?
Actually, it was Roland's idea to call the film 41st and Central. 41st and Central is the location where the headquarters of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was. And it was also the location of a huge shootout between the Panthers, 11 Panthers at that particular time, 9 men and 2 women. And it was a five-hour shootout with 300 police officers, including SWAT, and it was the debut of SWAT. So that is the climax of our film, because shortly after the court case on 41st and Central, the L.A. chapter was expelled from the Black Panther Party.
In making the film, tell us about the footage that you use. You said some of it came from the LAPD's own footage. There's obviously new interviews that you yourself have done with former members of the party. But there was also footage from films and TV at the time.
Yeah, we found footage from films, footage from television. We've liberated a lot of footage that we're not even sure who owns the footage. But before we would obviously screen the film on television, which is our eventual goal, you know, everything has to be, you know, cleared.
You have
everything.
To get all the permissions.
Yes. But in the beginning, in the early stages, there was nothing. It was very, very hard to find. This stuff is rare. We've gotten stuff from out in the community, photographs, footage. Like I said, the archive of the LAPD, they shot the shootout at 41st and Central because this was going to be their crowning, you know, their glory of introducing SWAT to the community. But, you know, things didn't go out that way. I also like to mention Fred Hampton, because Fred Hampton was murdered in Chicago just a few days, about 3 days before the attempted, before the raid on the offices here in L.A. And we all believe that at that time, we know that COINTELPRO was involved, the FBI was involved, so that law enforcement, they were in contact with each other in different cities and whatnot. And I just like to mention Fred Hampton. Mm. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but listeners can catch the film this Friday through the rest of the week at Culver Plaza Theaters, beginning this Friday, 9919 Washington Boulevard. My guests have been Gregory Everett and Gary Walker. Thank you both so much for joining us, and best of luck
to you.
Thank
you for having us.
Thank you. And can I mention our website?
Very quickly.
The1central.com.
So 41central.com, and we'll link to that from our site later today as well. And for Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Huey Newton once said, "There is no reason for the establishment to fear me, but it has every right to fear the people collectively, for I am one with the people." That's Huey Newton. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Noor Al-Samarai and Chris Bennett are our interns. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Special thanks to Martina Steiner. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Listen to the show online and find links, local events, and other information at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8. Whoa.